Okay, so before we get started, I'm Karen Evans. I'm in the Department of Immunology right here at Rockville Park. And how many of you have taken immunology as undergrad or graduate school? Maybe half of you? And how many have taken it in our introductory course, our MIR 511? So I recognize at least a couple of you. Yeah, good. So you have a pretty good background, and for those of you that took it in the other course, it's going to be incredibly similar. Maybe only a few different things. But on the other hand, if you look at from the point of view, you're going to go, really well, which is good. So I took my first immunology course as a graduate student at NIU. And I was interested in immunology somewhat, but, you know, this is many hundreds of years ago. So it was one of those interesting kind of eye-opening experiences. And it's actually the history of immunology course that really caught my attention and really made me excited about the whole discipline. So hopefully I'll do the same for you, that I'll at least give you a good context. It feels just a lot, doesn't it? Yeah.
So it's not so loud to me.
And this is kind of a very easy kind of lecture for those of you who have been taking it, because now is it loud enough? Can you still hear? Alright, so because it's really basically kind of putting together the story. We could do an entire course on the history of immunology immediately enough, so we're going to condense it. But why is it relevant in 2016? It's because you cannot watch any news program, 60 Minutes, pick up Time Magazine, People Magazine, anything, without being bombarded with the immune response. And particularly because of all the advances that have happened in using immunology to treat cancer. So it is so pervasive. I did a PBS nationwide program, an hour-long interview on immunology and how it impacts cancer. That's how topical it is. And so, and we had calls coming from all over the country. I did an interview just within the past year at Wall Street Journal. You know, it's that kind of lay public thing where people really are interested to know. So I'm guessing you actually know a lot of the parameters of the immune response already. But I hopefully can fill in a little of the gaps. But actually, my whole role is to be the prelude to the next segments on the immune response, so you'll learn a little bit more detail. So that's what the goal is here when we talk about the history of immunology. In terms of the exam, so just listening to what Henry Block said about the grades, you'll have a good chance to do well on my section of the exam. In the past, you had to memorize everyone and really be prepared to pull it together. But we've been, the last few years, doing my section as a take-home. So you're going to get mine as a take-home. Don't work on it together. If it's really obvious that you're working together, that won't really help you. So you really want to do the background reading. I handed out a paper and then sent it out to you, I think, the PDF. It turns out, so that paper just came out just within a few months ago. It came out in August. It came out actually right when I taught the first segment. It is so perfectly tailored to what we have today. It was just really fun to see it. And we're celebrating Metchnikoff's anniversary, 100 years of his death. So, kind of funny to celebrate somebody's death, I suppose. But to see the landmark advances and contributions he's made to the field of immunology, there are a lot of really fantastic. So that one I brought this in South, and it's all very well done. So take a look at that, because your exam will incorporate some aspect of that, as well as the final assignment at the end.
Okay, so with that as an introduction, this is really why I'm introducing the whole course. So you're going to have coming up, you're going to learn about cells of the immune system. So we'll be introducing the obvious basic cell types and have a better understanding of what organisms have it. Antibodies and their structure-function relationship, and how they're generated, T-cell-based immunity, which is where it's the hot topic for anti-tumor therapies, are really trying to augment the T-cell arm. So you'll get a better understanding of that from Scott Abrams. You'll, of course, have heard from Dr. Tanavala about antibodies, and I think it's going to be Bonnie Highlander doing the lecture on the cells of the immune system. And then that should set you up for lectures in the coming semester on immunotherapy that Kelvin Lee, who's the chair of our department, will be giving. So that's where we want to go overall in this whole thing. So my objectives for you are to get a historical perspective. You know, when we're doing our research, we're trained to think about always being at the cutting edge, doing things that nobody else has done. We kind of get lulled into thinking that everything we do is completely novel. But the field of immunology is based on thousands of years of observation. So I want to give you a little bit of that contexture of, in terms of where things have come. It's really fascinating. I always, Michelle in my lab always has a nice pile of papers on Mondays. And I wasn't here yesterday, so mine was Tuesday where I was going through. And it always strikes me how many of the basic fundamental aspects of these very high-powered Nature Immunology, JX Med, PNAS papers are founded on original observations that came maybe even 100 years ago. That there's a certain tenet of what we expect out of the immune response that we all have to satisfy every single time we publish something. And so, you know, thinking about it that way, that's kind of why I think it's very important to have a historical perspective on the research that really defined the immunology discipline. And then also to be introduced to some of the key concepts that are driving interest in using immunology as a tool to fight cancer, to fight it and also to diagnose it. So it's pervasive throughout the field. So in terms of the textbook, you have your cancer textbook already. So chapter 15 is probably the most relevant. It's not super, super relevant. I would say that most of what you need to know is going to come out of the lecture and also that assigned paper I gave you in cells. So, but if you want any background reading, certainly the concept of immune surveillance in cancer is covered in this chapter and tumor immunology. But of course, that's a cancer textbook, so basic immunology isn't covered nearly as much. So here's the timeline. This is what we're going to try to cover today, is this whole concept from about 500 BC up to the present. And so we've got a lot to cover. We'll cover it pretty quickly, just hitting some highlights. Most of this whole period for thousands of years was really dominated by the recognition that there is an immune response. And the understanding the mechanisms underlying it didn't come out until the last 100, 150 years. So we'll package all of our understanding into really a short time frame. And most of this period, it made sense because the diseases were so devastating, catastrophic in terms of people being affected by Black Death, smallpox epidemics. We're going to talk about that a lot because it's a great example of how our understanding of the immune response came out of studying of disease. Very much like our understanding of the immune response is really dependent on what we learned about cancer, because cancer and pathogens actually have a lot of things in similarity. So we'll talk a lot about that. So the goal really, nobody really cared about the ins and outs of the immune response other than, can it protect me from disease? But then we'll get into more of the molecular mechanisms, and of course it's not surprising that was finally honed with the idea that we got a better understanding of cell-cell interactions, molecule-molecule interactions, how DNA, transcriptional regulation, you had to understand that to get a better feel for what's going on in the immune response. So we'll talk about that, and then a little bit about tumor immunity. Okay, so again, only very briefly covered in Bob Weinberg's book. So in terms of the immune response, because it is a fundamental survival mechanism, there's this concept in organisms of these various types of protection. So we have the obvious fight or flight, so that, you know, an organism makes a decision to hang around or live another day and get out of here. So there are these basic organisms, they're protective barriers to our bodies. Our skin is probably considered one of our best protective barriers. The internal lining of our entire intestinal tract and urinary genital tract is all protective. And that's so surprising. It's lined in higher organisms and mammals by immune organs that are protective. So if the barrier to your skin is broached, you have an immune network set up really, really close to try to deal with that. So they go hand in hand in hand as far as that goes in terms of protection. So in terms of the immune response, complexity certainly depends on the type of organism. In vertebrates, there are highly organized lymphoid systems, complex organs, and you're going to learn a lot about that in the next lecture from Dr. Highlander. Obvious examples are the spleen, the lymph nodes, the Peyer's patches, the thymus, the bone marrow, and the blood. We all forget about the blood as being one of the major lymphoid organs. It doesn't function in the blood. There are some exceptions, but it's an important bridge to bringing cells to the right place at the right time, as well as other soluble mediators. And so we have a circulatory system as well in vertebrates. But lower organisms as well have a very fine-tuned immune response. And so we have a paper we published a few years ago where we studied, I have to admit, I was pretty shocked at the common aspects about the immune response in organisms. We've studied everything from man and tigers and elephants and, you know, you name it. We had a blast with this project. All the way down to birds who have only a partial developed immune response, immune organs, but they have the same lymphocytes we do. And some of the regulatory mechanisms in terms of cytokines and factors and so on, exactly the same. And it carried down even further to trout and to frogs, etc. So there's a lot of, they don't have the same lymphoid organs we do, but they have the same lymphocytes. So they have a really developed immune response. So this is one of the, I think, the lessons that I think you can take away from evolution is if something is maintained through multiple organisms, it usually has a really tremendous survival benefit. So the fact that there's these common features across evolution, millions and millions, 400, 600 million years, where these animals have diverged from a common node, lymphocytes have been maintained. So I think it gives you some idea of how important the immune system is. So the term immunity is Latin. So, you know, it's actually originated. It was used in Roman times as a financial term. So if the emperor said that you were exempt from paying taxes, you were considered immune. And so, but then it didn't take very long for people to carry over that term to disease. So if you were not subject to getting a disease, then you were considered immune. And that's where the basics of that terminology comes from. So of course there were religious overtones at that time to explain it. You know, you happen to be a really, really good person and deserving, or you went to the temple all the time and paid off the gods as much as possible, you might be immune. And that was sort of the driving feature of that aspect. Financial and religious was kind of dominating it. So, but it was recognized pretty quickly, and we're going to talk about one example of a very early observation of the immune response. It was clear, it was protective. The goal in terms of the general properties of the immune response are to defend an organism against infectious agents. And there were rampant epidemics and pandemics all the way back thousands and thousands of years. So the innate immune response is common among all organisms, everything from high mammals all the way down to primitive organisms, that where you have these cells of the innate immune response. So natural killer cells, they are sort of like a basic defender that's rapidly mobilized. Polymorphonuclear cells or neutrophils, monocytes, megakaryocytes, et cetera, are all part of the very basic immune response. And they really don't care what they see, they'll be mobilized really quickly. So there's no specificity, really. They can't distinguish if you are exposed to arsenic versus you're exposed to influenza in a general sense. Then with higher organisms, only the vertebrates, but remember, vertebrates, everything from mammals to fish and amphibious animals, have these adaptive immune response. And the key cell types in the adaptive immune response are B lymphocytes and T lymphocytes. Okay? So we'll come back to why they're even named B and T cells. So you at least have the history of that, which is kind of fun. And then that's only in vertebrates. Okay. And the key aspect of the immune response, we're going to talk about five hallmarks. And I guarantee that somehow that will weave into your exam somehow. Because I think we need to know the five hallmarks of the immune response as a card-carrying, having taken any kind of course in immunology. But one of the fundamentals is that you can recognize self from non-self. Okay? So in a bigger sense, and we'll talk about a Nobel laureate that studied transplant, and you could recognize whether you had a skin graft from somebody very distantly related or similar to you, but also in lower organisms. And I'm going to show you one example of that in sponge. And that's a very famous experiment that was done by Wilson's group back in 1907. Probably be good if I had my glasses. So what he did was he took two strains and I think, you know, in terms of thinking about science in a broad way, what makes an experiment powerful is when they're very, very simple and you have a clear outcome. And here's a great example of doing that. So what he did was he took two different strains of sponge and he draws them as being different colors. He dissociates them into single cells. And sponge are really cool animals because they can reform from a single cell all the way back to a full functioning sponge with all its little filtration system, etc. So they're really amazing. So he took these two strains and he dissociates them. He's got the white strain single cell, the gray strain single cell, and he mixes them. So you've got like a gamish. And then he looked to see, what do you get out of it? Do you get some kind of chimeric sponge that's gray and white? Or do you get completely the original sponge species again? That's what he got. Isn't that amazing? So literally he got the exact same thing. They were able to distinguish self from non-self and push the non-self out. So there are obviously these really basic fundamental mechanisms. A lot of that is even very well understood even today. But there's basic recognition. So the great example is when we fight infection, we are recognizing that the influenza-infected cells are different from our normal cells, right, in the epithelial lining. So you know, we do it in a really sophisticated way. Think about it one step more sophisticated, cancer. If you have liver cancer, your liver cells are cancerous are sitting right next to normal liver cells. So somehow your immune response is able to distinguish them. That's why we're so excited about using the immune response to fight cancer, because you have the hope that this immune cell could recognize the cancerous cell that is 99% a normal liver cell, but there's just enough about it that's different. And if they can use that recognition, kill off the cancer cell and leave your intact liver, because let's face it, you're not going to be in good shape if you don't have a liver, right? So that's why people are so interested in it. It's this fundamental ability of the immune system to recognize self from non-self. And we can't pretend that in just this little five-module immunology section in this course, you're going to get a full sense of that. But that's kind of the basic underlying principle that you should be thinking about. Okay. So I want to talk about some of the early observations that people had that are recorded for recognition that you could have protection against infectious disease. And that was in the context of epidemics. So it was recognized really early on that there were people, yes, a lot of people died from the Black Death, but there were a few people that were protected. You know what's super amazing? They had some really groundbreaking papers that came out within the last 10 years. They figured out why people back in the Middle Ages there would be whole families wiped out, and there would be like one little kid that would survive. They analyzed the bones and the tissues from people, you know, that would have been, because they were all buried in these mass graves, and some of them were burned, but they analyzed the tissues, and they found that people were lacking a particular protein that allowed the infectious agent to bind on, an immune cell protein, in fact, a chemokine receptor. So, you know, we even now we're overlaying and going back and getting an understanding of what, why some people have an immune response and some people don't. And some of it's genetic. So there's this recognition that there are some people that are resistant. So obviously once people recognize that, it's not a big leap to say, then let's try to figure out something we can do to make people resistant, like acquire resistance, which is exactly what the immune response is professionally doing. And so those really go hand in hand. And that's what drives the field of immunology. It was because of, I don't know if I know of another discipline that there's such a link between protection and the mechanisms of protection that drove the field. When you think about biochemistry, I mean, yes, generally that's going to be the case, but here's a whole field that was driven because people wanted to try to be more protected from infectious agents. So here's a great example. And this is one of my first graduate courses. I remember my professor in immunology talking about Thucydides. So I remember it to this day. And so that's why I always wanted to make sure we included it in our lectures. He was basically like a war correspondent on the front lines of the Peloponnesian Wars back in 500 BC. And so he wrote these tremendous, like, encyclopedia-type volumes about the wars. And, you know, but one of the things he noticed is that more people were dying from epidemics than they ever were from battle. And he was really fascinated by it. So he wrote this amazing, really insightful statement that gives you a glimpse about the appreciation of the immune response way back in 500 BC. So what he said is, yet still the ones who felt, you know, he's talking about the soldiers. The soldiers that felt the most pity for the sick and the dying were those that had had the plague themselves. So this is typhus fever, it turns out, this particular plague, and had recovered from it. So these are those very few soldiers that turned out to be resistant, okay? They knew what it was like to be sick, and at the same time, they felt themselves to be safe, for no one ever caught the disease twice. So in 500 BC, they realized that if you're exposed and you survived it, you could actually be protected, and you don't get that disease again. Or if you do, the second attack was never fatal. That's a remarkable observation, right? I think it was helped by the fact that there were so many thousands and thousands of subjects to study that you would actually be able to draw those kinds of conclusions. So such people, the ones that survived, and even if they got it twice, it wasn't fatal, they were congratulated on all sides, and they themselves were so elated at the time of their recovery that they fondly imagined that they could never die of any other disease in the future. So there are two fundamental tenets of the immune response. There's the idea that if you're exposed to something, you could be protected. And the second piece is, while they wanted to think they were protected from every other disease that came along, it was a fond imagination. Thucydides recognized the fallacy of that. That, yes, you're protected against typhus fever, but something else comes along, smallpox, influenza, you're on your own. So the specificity of the immune response was recognized in these writings as well. Okay? So two really fundamental. I mean, that's what makes it really fun for all of us. We're in a science, any science that we're in, that there's that observational component where you can like actually think about all the data and draw conclusions, which is exactly what Thucydides was doing. So that's exactly, in the term of immunology, it's called memory. The idea that exposure to disease could result in subsequent immunity or memory. And the second is specificity. Protection from one disease did not confer general protection. You had to have an immune response to each one. Okay? Okay, so just broadening on that, these are the five hallmark characteristics of the immune response. So there's specificity. We just talked about that. And we're talking about real specificity, that the immune response can discriminate very minor differences in proteins or antigens or in lipids, etc., carbohydrate. Very, very minor changes can be recognized by the immune response. Immunologic memory, we just talked about it. In immunology terms, we call that recall response. So if you've been exposed to something and then you're re-exposed, you mount an immune response, but you mount it faster and at greater amplitude, much, much stronger immune response the second time around. And that's in part because you've got cells already there hanging out for the rest of your life in some cases, that are primed and ready to go, and you tickle them a little bit and they can ramp up very, very quickly. We talked about discrimination of self versus non-self. The sponge is a great example, but not so well defined in immunologic terms, but the whole field of immunology now has a better handle on why we can discriminate self versus non-self. Many Nobel Prizes given for all of this, by the way. Diversity. So it's estimated that we can recognize 10 to the 9th different antigenic determinants. And the cool thing about that is you didn't have to be exposed before. You're just ready to go. You can recognize that many. That's a pretty tremendous amount. So what that tells you is you are not ramped up at all times to recognize 10 to the 9th. You have a few cells. So we have to have a very active way of expanding our pool of cells. And so that several Nobel laureates got the prize for their views on that aspect. And finally, self-regulation. And that's key to the immune response. If you have a really, really potent immune response to infection in your tissue, and you don't bring it back in control, the immune response is incredibly expensive from an energy point of view. So you don't want to devote that much of your metabolic energy to always having an immune response. So it's key, and also there's the risk of inappropriate attack on your normal tissues. And what's that called? When the immune response is attacking your normal tissue? Autoimmunity. Yeah, exactly. You all were saying the same thing. So that's the key. You aren't actually having the level of regulation you'd hope to have. And the converse is, in cancer, we get an immune response. Judah Folkman stood right on this stage. He's one of the really amazing, groundbreaking people in studying how the vasculature affects cancer. And I remember long ago, many years ago, he's been dead for over 10, sitting out in one of those chairs, and I'll never forget him saying that everybody, when they go in and they look at accident victims and they look at their tissues, 30% or so have what you can diagnose by, as a pathologist, as breast cancer, prostate cancer, liver cancer. So, you know, we're actually all living in a situation where we're controlling that and not letting, so we have no, you know, we can go our whole life and never have any evidence of it because the immune response is constantly attacking and keeping it in control. It was sort of a shocking, and the whole room sat there like, oh my God, and you're looking at yourself like, whoa. But the immune response can protect you. Where you get into trouble is if you dial down the immune response, which is a normal reaction. That's what why we don't have autoimmunity when we're fighting infections. But so that's why in immunotherapy people are trying to ramp it back up and break the normal mechanisms of regulation and turning it down. So this is incredibly important in terms of whether immune response is effective and is not pathogenic in itself. Okay? All right, so with that as background, we're going to spend a fair segment talking about smallpox because it was in the context of smallpox that some of the very major fundamental discoveries were made in terms of immunology. And it's credited with really creating the whole discipline of immunology. It came out of this work in smallpox. So we're going to take a few minutes and talk about that so you get a sense of it. Now, you guys, even I, was not too frightened about smallpox because the last case in the United States was 1947. And the last case of smallpox in the free world that was not like a laboratory accident was in 1977 in Somalia. So my generation, we were all immune, all your parents were immunized for smallpox because it was still dangerous enough that you couldn't take a risk. None of you guys have been immunized. So because it was no longer a threat, there's no point in immunizing people against things you'll never be exposed to. Of course, you know, when all those decisions were made, we weren't thinking about bioterrorism. So there are a lot of issues about just the study of this disease, and it's still really pertinent in 2016, shockingly and sadly, I would say. So I want to go through that a little bit. So it's the first disease that was clinically identified. Numerous epidemics. When they went in to the mummies and they pulled off their wraps, their faces, you could see, you know, because they were all mummified, you could see their faces were covered with smallpox, you know. Even back in ancient Egypt, they were adept at makeup. And so, and this is all the way back, 1500 B.C. is prevalent. The King Ramses, for example, so what, you know, wasn't just in certain areas, it was everywhere. So the noble families all had it. It was a major, major thing. Okay, and it led, as I said, to the first defined immunology experiments. So what is it? It's a virus. It's ingested through the nasal pharyngeal region. It infects the epithelial cells lining the trachea, and from there it spreads via the blood to the skin epithelium. And it's really nasty looking. Here you can see these horrific lesions. And they usually tend to be out in the extremities, in the face, the arms, the legs, out in the extreme areas. Okay, we can all live with some pox. We can all like wear a lot of makeup. You know, when you go to those old homes and they have the little fans right by the fireplace, that's so because the women would have to wear wax makeup so thick because of their pox that then they had to be in danger when they sat by the fireplace. It would just melt and drip off. So they have special fans made for it. We can live with that, you know. Here's the problem. 40% mortality rate. And to this day, there's no cure. So out of five people, two of you are going to die. That's the tremendous, it's a devastating disease, all right? No cure yet. And who does it affect? It affects children and young adults the most. And so that is really also, in terms of the society, this is not the population you want to get rid of. So it had major, major impact. And it led people to take extreme measures to try to protect someone because there were people that were protected. They had natural protection or could acquire it. Very much like Thucydides. People that got smallpox, if they lived through it, never really got it again in the same way. Much more minor. Okay, so there are many early attempts in ancient China. This one I love. They actually would take the pustules off of someone that had smallpox, dry it, grind it up into a fine powder, and then they had special silver tubes that they would use. And this is all happening thousands of years ago. So if you were a male, you had to sniff it on the left side, and on the female, you had to sniff it on the right. And that was supposed to be the trick to the whole thing. Of course, remember, and the same with, there are these amazing literature surrounding the new colonies, you know, here in America, because so they wiped out the Indians because that's the disease that they'd never been exposed to, so that was brought over with the ships, and so that was the epidemic there for sure. But in the colonists, it was still rampant. So I've read a lot of the original works. So some are by Cotton Mather, and it's unbelievable. So they would, if you had a baby that was healthy, you would take it and put it in the crib with a baby that had blatant breakout smallpox and let them rub up against each other with the hope that the little baby would be protected. George Washington, I remember reading, you know, because I've been teaching this for quite a while, and I remember reading this book my daughter brought home when she was little about George Washington. I'm like, oh my God, I never knew that. Turns out George Washington, when he would go down from his plantations with his brother in Jamaica, they had a lot of, they brought a lot of crops and a lot of goods and so on back and forth to Jamaica, and that was part of the big shipping trade. He contracted smallpox, George Washington and his brother, and he was literally delirious. It was like a sort of this autobiographical article I read. And when he woke up a month later, his brother was dead. He nearly died from smallpox. It was everywhere. So people took these really risky things, because here's the problem. You stick your baby in a crib with another baby that has smallpox, that's virulent smallpox. So when your baby gets it, it has, you know, a 2 out of 5 chance of dying. So that's pretty bad odds, you know, to take that risk. And it was really the same thing with these tubes in China, et cetera, and all these kinds of things. So I think what I'm trying to tell you is how desperate people were to try to protect their kids. They would take that risk rather than just be exposed and then have no chance. They were trying to create immunity. So along comes this woman. Her name is Mary Pierpont Montague. And she, the story about her is that she was supposedly this absolutely beautiful, beautiful woman, unparalleled beauty. And she fell in love with this man who her parents didn't approve of. And she was very, very wealthy, nobility in England. This is all back in the 1700s. So she, somewhere along the line, though, contracts smallpox. She loses her beauty. It's really, you know, really hits her hard. Some of her brothers die from smallpox. She's very, very attuned to this whole thing. She ends up eloping with her fiancé. They get married. He becomes an ambassador. I think maybe the noble family's like kind of shoved him out. So he gets sent far away to Turkey. And it's in Turkey that she learns about this really interesting thing. It's sort of a takeoff of all these other procedures that we've been talking about. It's called variolation. And variola is Latin for smallpox. And variolation, it means artificial exposure. And basically, what they did was they found people that had smallpox. They tried to pick people that weren't really sick so much, like hopefully wasn't so virulent. They ground it up, much like the Chinese did, made a little powder, and they inject it right into people. And a lot of them were protected. A lot of them died, because it was live smallpox. But, you know, a lot of them were protected, and she was so impressed by it. She got variolated. She had her husband variolated, her children. She was willing to risk her children's lives and do this. So that's the climate. And she was really, really, really an advocate of it. So she wrote back to her friend, Sarah Criswell. This letter is dated 1717. So this is how long ago it was. And this is her view of it. Just the context is Sarah Criswell dies 9 years later from smallpox. So she didn't get variolated. And they weren't doing it in England. And Mary Pierpont Montague is still down in Turkey. So she writes this letter. I'm going to tell you a thing that I'm sure will make you wish yourself here in Turkey. The smallpox, so fatal and so general amongst us in England, is here entirely harmless. Which, of course, isn't true. It's not a 2 to 5 ratio, but it's still, people were dying when they got variolated. But she felt it was harmless by the invention of engrafting or invariolation. I love this part. I know we just had the other course earlier this semester. And the cynicism, you know, is amazing. Like, not long ago, I was at a bead shop because my son was getting married, and I had to get some beady thing or something. And this woman leans over and she goes, oh, I stupidly had my tag on. I forgot I had it. She, you work at Roswell Park. I read that you can cure cancer. And the scientists at places like Roswell Park and Sloan Kettering, they can all cure it, but they're just not doing it because they're making too much money, you know, and your salary depends on it. I remember I'm like, huh, I'll just take those beads. You know, like the anger wells up. Well, this is Sarah. Criswell's letter from Lady Montague is sort of the same idea, because she really felt that doctors actually, if they could incorporate this variolation, they could solve the whole smallpox problem. But she didn't think anybody would do it because they didn't want to lose their income. So that's exactly what she goes on to say. I'm patriot enough to take pains to bring this useful invention into fashion in England. And I should not fail to write to some of our doctors very particularly about it. If I knew any one of them that I thought had virtue enough to destroy such a considerable branch of their revenue for the good of mankind. So she thought she had the answer, and she thought nobody would do it because it wasn't going to benefit them financially. You know, 1717, so we're still thinking that way. So she gets pulled back. Her husband gets finally out from under the cloud, and he comes back from Turkey. She single-handedly lobbies in England to adopt the procedures of variolation. She convinces the royal family. She gets the Prince and Princess of Wales, and we know how much life is dominated by the Prince and Princess of Wales today, so you can imagine what kind of influence they had back then. Because they not only got variolated, but they variolated their children back in 1722. So they were willing to risk their kids' lives to try this. That was pretty impressive. And what a coup for Lady Montagu. And then there was widespread variolation going on in England, more in the cities where there's a tight population, very easy to contract smallpox, less so in the country. All right? So all that's great, but there's still a tremendous danger because that was live smallpox. All right? So they're trying to generate immune response. They have absolutely no idea the parameters of the immune response and what was happening at a molecular or cellular level, but they're taking these risks. So this is all back in the early 1700s. And then this is the climate and the absolute desperation people are willing to take to try to protect their families. Along comes Edward Jenner, and he's going to do the very first immunology experiment. So he wrote a paper, so this is some, 80 years after Lady Montagu, and he calls it the Inquiry into the Causes and Effects of Variola Vaccinae. And so he's using this variola concept of artificial exposure, and this is the Latin word for cow and vaccination. That's where our term that we're talking about, we just all heard a seminar today in immunology about vaccination. We had a world famous person come as the outside reader for my student's PhD a couple days ago. What was she talking about? Vaccinating against cancer. So these same terms are, this is where all this comes from. He wrote this paper, it's over 70 pages, so no page restrictions at all at those times, and it's all about this whole process. And the story that is folklore story, but this is his own writings, that's what he wrote up in the paper, is that he's a country doctor, been treating people with smallpox for a long time. I have not really gotten into how these doctors would take those risks, but presumably maybe they had gotten some mild form of the disease. But he sees a milkmaid, and she has these pox on her hands. And he says, I really hate to tell you, because it's kind of like on the side of her hands and so on, up her arms. He said, I think you have smallpox. The milkmaid basically says, that's not possible. I'm a milkmaid. I've had the cowpox. And so, you know, cowpox is something that you get from the udders of the cows as the women milk the cows. And it looks very, very similar to smallpox. So it wasn't a big jump for him to start thinking about, and the milkmaids were known. So, I grew up and people talked about milk being a thing that you used like in lotions and so on to protect your skin. But really why milkmaids were known for having this beautiful skin was this cowpox idea. So he comes up with a hypothesis that perhaps the milkmaids are protected from smallpox because they have a disease so similar. And so it's the same thing as Thucydides said. You have a disease, and if you survive it, and everybody knew cowpox is completely benign. Nobody dies from cowpox ever. But these milkmaids then were protected. That was his hypothesis. So he went back through all his medical records. Then he got his colleagues involved. He could not find one example of a milkmaid who had had cowpox who ever succumbed to smallpox. So it was a pretty good hypothesis. So then He was trained formally in science. So he decides to do a testable experiment and test his hypothesis. Just like, you know, the five steps of hypothesis-driven research that you guys all wrote on the board when you were in fifth grade, that's what he was doing. So he goes out and he does the first experiment. And that pre-exposure to cowpox protects against smallpox infection. Again, trying to generate an immune response, but this time not waiting to see if you lucked out and happened to be one of the chosen few that was protected, but to create protection, but in a safer way. Because as I said, nobody dies from cowpox, so it was appealing because it was much safer than variolation using live smallpox. Okay? So his teacher was John Hunter, and he's famously, we used to have this up on the board. It comes up and down in my lab over the years. But literally, why think? Why not try the experiment? Sometimes you can think yourself out of anything, and you know you have so many reasons why something won't work and this and that. Sometimes you just have to do it. And that's what Edward Jenner had learned from John Hunter, and so he did. And most of you probably don't even know. Does anybody here know who Michael Jordan is? Oh, good. Like some classes, nobody knows who Michael Jordan is. It's like very disturbing to me to realize how life is going by. But my son and I adored Michael Jordan and loved every game he was ever in, and I still think he's the best. But he was sponsored by Nike, and he'd always say, just do it. And sometimes that's what you have to do in the lab. You know, think it through, have all your controls as best you can. But sometimes you just have to try it out and see what happens. So that's what Edward Jenner did. Of course, he's dealing with a lot more dangerous situation than most of us in the lab. So here he is. What he did was he found a milkmaid who had active cowpox. And her name was Sarah Nelms. He scraped off her cowpox, ground it up, much like they'd been doing for over 1,000 years. Made a pustule and injected it. Who does he inject it into? A little boy, James Phelps. 8-year-old little boy. No record of where his parents are at all. And I want you all to know that Edward Jenner had sons of his own. But they're not the one that got injected with this. So they inject little James. Also, there's no record, because this is the lucky part. He waited 2 weeks. And we now know that the immune response takes about 2 weeks to be fully in gear. So if he had injected him and then waited a day and injected him, or 4 days, James Phelps would be flat. Okay. So I don't know how many experiments he did, but all we know is he injects James Phelps. And what's one of the things that you learned when you were in fifth grade about scientific experimentation? What's one of the keys in terms of testing a hypothesis? Like, is one experiment enough? No, that's why we publish, right? Because we want to, one, we have stringent requirements, all of us, when we publish, have repeated the experiments and document it and show all the data and everything. I mean, it's become very, very, very high bar in terms of that. But you want it so somebody else can reproduce your work, right? And then the best substantiation of something that you've shown is when somebody else, independent of you, in another lab, goes and reproduces it and uses it as the foundation, reproducibility. So he didn't just inject this kid once. How many times do you think he injected him? No right or wrong answer. What do you think? 5 is a good answer. Right. How many times are we supposed to repeat experiments? Like, what's the golden rule that we all use? 3, right? 5, I think, is good. Yep. 20 times. 20 times he found the most virulent smallpox he could find and injected in this little kid. And he did not succumb to smallpox because he had one prior exposure to cowpox. Imagine how revolutionary this is. Unbelievable, right? So it really took off in England and across the world. So here is his home. Maybe Lady Montague was right, because he's just a little country doctor. He has a beautiful home. And this is his clinic, but he didn't want all these people coming in and out of his house, so he made a little hut in the backyard, and that is where he injected people continuously with cowpox. really, really impressive, groundbreaking feat. It was picked up all over the world. In Spain, when they were sending, wanted to vaccinate in the colonies in Florida and South America. So what did they do? They grabbed, again, orphan little boys, poor kids, nobody's looking over them, and they dragged them down from the mountains, they injected them, because they thought they had to have live cowpox. So they made a human chain. They grabbed 23 little boys, and they started out, first one, and then on the ship, going over, because it took months to get there, you know, they kept inoculating. So when they finally arrived at the colonies, they had full live cowpox, which they injected. Their claim is that they saved over 150,000 just in one little locale of Indians and colonists' lives because of the injection. So it was really, I mean, this didn't just happen only in England. It picked up everywhere. So, and there's a nice quote from Thomas Jefferson, who himself was a really elite scientist, and he was really impressed by this. So he actually was prompted to write to Edward Jenner, and this is out of his letter. "Yours is the comfortable reflection that mankind can never forget that you have lived. Future nations will know by history only that the loathsome smallpox existed." Pretty powerful statement, you know, coming from a really elite scientist. So unfortunately that wasn't really true, because smallpox was still rampant. But that climate for discovery was generated by this. And of course it was super lucky, right, that they recognized there was a benign form of the disease that they could exploit. Okay, so the cure for smallpox, as I mentioned, has never been found. You can only be protected. And for example, in the late 70s, a lab in London was studying smallpox, and they broke a vial. And there were five people in the room when it was broken, in a hood, in a laminar flow hood. Two of them died. Okay, so it's really rampant. Now, every year I also do this literature search, because there's a whole big debate about whether there are now, I think, 60 tubes left. About half of them here in the United States in the Center for Disease Control, half of them in Russia. So those are supposed to be the only two sets left. Everything else has been destroyed. And I've been doing this a long time. There's always debate ethically whether they should destroy the vials or keep them. The big powers, the U.S., the Russia, they want to keep them because they feel if there ever is germ warfare, then at least they have the original organism to go back to try to figure things out. And the other countries feel like it's way too dangerous. So it's like a raging debate. The last time they took votes, I thought it was actually going to be solved in 2014. They stayed it, and they have not come back and revisited it. However, in 2014, in the NIH, they went into some laboratory unlocked in a cardboard box. Was all these tubes, and they found two tubes of live virulent smallpox just sitting there in the lab, open, big, huge scandal, and 300 other virulent pathogens completely unattended, like really, really dangerous things, everything from HIV to anything you can imagine in these little tubes. So, you know, it kind of makes you worry and wonder about what's out there still, but there's a big debate about it. But in 1966, just to give you an idea, over 10 million people were infected per year. 10 million. So what is that? About 2 out of 10 would die. Okay? In terms of heart disease and cancer today, 10 million is about the number. So that's what major impact just this one pathogen was having on the world. So that prompted the World Health Organization actually to start an initiative to eradicate smallpox, which was actually pretty controversial in itself, because mankind is pretty constrained about going out and eliminating any organism. So that was a big thing. But they did that by active vaccination using cowpox as the vaccine. And this just gives you an idea from 1967 all the way to 1975 that how cleared they did in just using this worldwide vaccination strategy of eliminating. And as I mentioned, the last recorded infection was 1977 in Somalia, of actual natural infection. So it's actually an example of an active vaccination procedure. So remember, this is people being vaccinated before they're exposed to the disease to protect them. So it's the first infectious disease to be eradicated worldwide. Ethical debates, we already talked about that. But it set the stage for trying to understand now the immune response. What is responsible for this protection? And more important, can we borrow from that to try to get protection to other diseases? That was the whole idea and strategy. So widespread acceptance of that method of vaccination. It's much safer, much safer than variolation. They did think, as I mentioned about King Carlos, that only live organisms could work. So that was sort of technically difficult, hard to get this reagent out. This is way back at the time of Jenner. And they certainly recognized, just like Thucydides, that protection is not passed from generation to generation, and it doesn't protect you against other pathogens. It's very specific for smallpox. Okay, so that is the climate that you all learned about probably second grade, about Louis Pasteur. So, but this, remember, Louis Pasteur, although arrogant as he was, brilliant, genius, arrogant guy, he might have thought he worked in a vacuum, but he fully understood the impact of Edward Jenner. And so, some 100 years later, when he's doing his research on rabies and cholera toxin and other things, it was founded on the observations of Edward Jenner. Okay? So we've got a famous quote, who's considered the father of immunology, Louis Pasteur: chance favors the prepared mind. And here's an example, like all science, serendipity, chance, luck, all factors, every scientist you ever know could give you 5 examples at least of groundbreaking work in their labs that came out, not because they totally predicted it, but they had the wherewithal to figure out it was important. That was Louis Pasteur's genius. And so here's an example where they were studying cholera, which is a bacteria in chickens, a horrible disease. And he had people, they were trying to understand what causes the infections, because they figured that was sort of mechanistically how they could figure things out. And trying to figure out, not really so much to create protection actually in his lab, but he had somebody in the lab, and they would plate out the bacteria on petri dishes. And in France, I lived in France when I was growing up for a couple years. It's really true. Everybody goes on vacation in August. And this was August. And his guy, his technician, went on vacation. The bacteria dies on the plate. All right? He doesn't realize it. He comes back. He inoculates the chickens because they're studying the pathology. A lot of people don't know, but a lot of what Louis Pasteur studied wasn't human disease, actually. It was they were human diseases as well, but they are really rampant in agriculture. So, well, humans of course can get cholera, but this was something that was really devastating to livestock. So he hits the animal with this, what turned out to be dead attenuated bacteria, and the animal doesn't get the infection, and there's nothing to study. So the guy, you know, was frugal, as was Louis Pasteur, so he's like, oh, I better use all these chickens for something. So he goes and he challenges them now with lethal bacteria. Not a plant experiment at all, but the shock was that these animals were completely protected. They never got the infection at all. Imagine how revolutionary that is. You do not need to have an equivalent of a benign disease like cowpox. You could use a virulent pathogen, and as long as you knock out its efficacy so it can't divide, et cetera, it can serve as a vaccine. Unbelievable as far as that went. So that's what Louis Pasteur really, he figured it out. And first he was really angry about all this mess with all these chickens and, you know, very, very expensive. And then he started putting it together. Brilliant. So he called the process vaccination, in homage to Edward Jenner, because of that whole story, right? And he demonstrated something very important, that you don't have to have a live pathogen to get an immune response. That was critical. So much safer, and now you can expand it to many, many diseases. People are trying to vaccinate against cancer right now. So, you know, many diseases, not just infectious agents, but cancers and natural mutations, etc. He also came up with the idea that infectious disease has an identifiable causative agent, which really could revolutionize what they could do to knock it out, to use it as a pathogen. And that's really how the field gets dominated. Okay, so into that whole idea comes along Emil von Behring. So this is maybe 10, 20 years after Louis Pasteur's observations. And he is trying to understand now more the molecular basis of the immune response. So he's studying diphtheria, which it's a bacteria that causes like this membrane to form across your throat. It was really, really rampant epidemic in children. He was a pediatrician himself. So he's studying it in mice. And what he found was if he could remove the serum, so he uses killed bacteria to vaccinate, right? Then he goes in and he takes the serum out, gets rid of all the cells, and he passively takes the serum, he puts it into a new animal who's never seen bacteria, and now challenges it with live bacteria, fully protected. So there's, mechanistically, he's getting some insight on what's going on. What do you think might be in that serum that would be so protective? Antibodies. Exactly. A soluble factor that can circulate, right? The antitoxin in the serum can be protective and very, very specific. So it satisfies the criteria that we know for immune responses. It has to be highly specific. So it protects against diphtheria, but not against rabies, not against cholera toxin, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so that was really exciting. And then he gets partnered up with Paul Ehrlich, because this other guy, Koch, who had an institute. Koch got the Nobel Prize. Emil von Behring got the Nobel Prize. Paul Ehrlich gets the Nobel Prize. They all get the Nobel Prize, I think, in Germany. They get partnered, and they figure out the basis of this immune response, this antibody response, as you said. So he's considered to be, they're all like a link to the father of immunology, founder of immunology, and so on and so on. He's considered to be the founder of the scientific discipline of immunology. This and five other disciplines, actually, are credited to Paul Ehrlich, an amazing guy. Very, very broad impact. This is a quote from him: "The immune substances, in the manner of magic bullets, seek out the enemy." So he really believed in the power of these antitoxins or antibodies in the serum. So he put forward the first comprehensive theory for how antibodies are made. And some of it is actually very similar to how we think today with refinement. So it's called the side chain theory. And it addresses the question of how immune responses distinguish so many different factors with such specificity. Okay, so he's putting this forward. And it's in the context of yet another Nobel laureate, Emil Fischer, which you probably learned about in biochemistry, because he was famous for this lock and key kind of idea for enzymes and substrates. So the take-home message here is that you wouldn't get any of this if you weren't really a prolific reader. And Paul Ehrlich was. He knew everything that was going on in terms of science, and you'll see a pile of his papers that he reads. But he was well aware of Emil Fischer's whole idea of lock and key. And he started thinking about, I wonder if these antitoxins are recognizing pathogens in a very similar way. All right? So he comes up with this theory and he publishes it in 1897, the side chain theory. And it's the first actual hypothesis for how antibodies could be made. So that is, in itself is pretty amazing. And the idea here is that you have cells that have the capacity to make the antibody, and they have on the surface side chains. And the way he envisioned it is that a cell could have lots of side chains. In real life, you only have one recognition, like one cell can recognize one type of antigen. But then he pictures the antigen See how it's like a lock and key idea, a conformational shape that will engage. And the specificity is this one, this pathogen looks totally different than this one and totally different than this one. So when they engage these cell surface receptors, these side chains, it will provoke the cell to get super stimulated, and it will start producing tons and tons of the antibody factors, and they spill out. And they get out into the serum, and that was the magic that he envisioned. So he drew this in his paper, and I really was so taken with this idea, because his advocates loved it, because you could picture how it could happen, you know? His detractors hated it, because he actually had no data to support this paper. It was sort of an imaginary thing. I try to walk a careful balance in any major paper that we try to publish. We always put a little cartoon. We might have to put it in supplemental, but at the close of it, of the theory of what we think is happening, if we think it's a novel, you know, a nature immunology level paper, an immunity level paper, we put in a little cartoon, something good to remember. Put it in your grants too, your fellowship grants, in the beginning for your innovation, because there's something really satisfying to visualize what you think is happening and then go see the evidence that supports it or refutes it. So, but he kind of was the first to start doing that and then came up with this whole theory. Here he is in real life. Here are all the papers. You can see how well read he is. Here is his own drawing of the side chain theory. So it's really a new paradigm. It's emphasizing the idea that antibodies, circulating factors, are responsible for the immune response. Cells were responsible because they made those factors, but in his view, once that's done, it didn't matter. The immune response was all mediated by antibodies. He called them antitoxins and antibodies. So he's the first to coin that term. And the next 50 years, even when I started graduate school, which really wasn't 50 years ago, but was dominated by understanding the biochemical interactions between an antigen and an antibody and the combining region and all of that. So the study of cellular immunology is largely ignored. That's the paper I gave you to look at to give you some context, and you'll see how viciously Paul Ehrlich and Eli Metchnikoff fought over the concepts, because this Russian guy, Metchnikoff, was an advocate that cells were responsible for the immune response, but he had some problems in proving that. So this is antibody. You're going to learn all about that from Dr. Thanavala. This is the combining site. We now know that there are important functional regions out at this N-terminus and the C-terminus. We also know that the antibody response can be remarkably long-lived. So the estimate, and you can read through some of this, but just one example, from the big infection that happened here in the United States in 1918, they have taken people that are still surviving and they checked their serum levels, and they still have antibodies to that influenza 80 years later. Antibodies circulating only last for about 2 weeks. So there's a big disconnect. It turns out the cells that are responsible for making the antibodies, they can live for 3,000 years. So the antibody is not the limit to our lifespan. So if we could live 3,000 years, we could still make antibodies. So they're incredibly long-lived protective mechanisms. Here's Eli Metchnikoff. He had the flip side. He felt cells were important. He did this very famous experiment where he had starfish larvae, injected a wooden thorn, and under the microscope, he was pioneering in terms of his ability to see cells move and migrate. So he had these cells move in very, very quickly, and they start ingesting and breaking down that little wooden thorn. And so he's like, cells obviously are responding to a foreign object. Cells have to be responsible for the immune response. But what he couldn't reconcile was any specificity. The macrophage came, whether it was a piece of glass, whether it was a piece of wood, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, there were a lot, they really fought it out and contested. We now know that cells and antibodies are key to the immune response. They're the two arms of the adaptive immune response. So they finally came together, but not in their lifetime. It was pretty vicious. Actually, when you read some of the articles, and I think it might even be in the article I gave you, I read so many when in August, I'm not sure, but he was very suicidal, very depressed. He was horribly attacked in the field, Metchnikoff, because the other side, because of the specificity satisfaction, really took off. So he had a real struggle in terms of that. But
He's famous for the fact that he gave the first evidence that cells are responsible for the immune response to foreign antigens. Couldn't demonstrate specificity. It wasn't until really the 40s and 50s that people started to recognize that cells were really important players. We're going to go, because we started a little bit late with all the talk about the exam, we are going to go a couple minutes over, but not too much, because we're going to cover 50 years in about 10 minutes. So just to give you the heads up. So here they are, bitter enemies, really didn't like each other or their theories. Of course, they both get the Nobel Prize together in 1908. So, which I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall to see them give their talks, to be honest, as far as that went. But they set the foundation, and as you'll see in that article, here we are, 100 years after Metchnikoff died, we're still writing cell articles about the contributions of Elie Metchnikoff. So I think it's really fair to say that they completely revolutionized how we think of the immune response. So we're going to move forward now in this last century. The Institute Russell Park, he and the man Russell Park was onto it very quickly. Think about when this is all happening. This is when the Nobel Prizes are coming out in immunology, left and right, honest to God. The first Nobel Prize was given to an immunologist, the second. So they, you know, it's really dominating the field. And Russell Park, being so smart, figured that all out. So he hires people that are studying the immune response. So next door is the Gaylord, right, room. Here is Gaylord, famous for studying the immune response to cancer. And he recognized that patients could respond to cancer with the immune response very much like they respond to syphilis and influenza and smallpox, etc. And then also Close, there's a conference room in the Institute. Close, he actually studied leukemia, the idea of immune cell gone bad. And that's actually just exactly like our immunology program is. Half of us study immune response to cancer, and the other half study leukemia, lymphoma, immune cells gone bad. So that tradition is very strong here. All right, so we've got Paul Ehrlich, and we've got McFarlane Burnett, separated by some 50 years. McFarlane Burnett is a famous immunologist. We celebrate, I actually got to give some lectures on these guys in particular, fascinating people in themselves. And you all took what do we call it? Ethical conduct of researchers, RPN 540 or whatever. So if you all took it, you actually heard about McFarlane Burnett. Remember, we talked about him in terms of mentoring, et cetera, in that course. So he had a very similar theory as to Paul Ehrlich in that side chain theory of how antibodies are produced. But where he got his Nobel Prize was actually for studying transplant rejection. Because in wars, just like Thucydides and the Peloponnesian War, war has shaped our medicine throughout. Heart surgery came out of the advances from the Vietnam War. Big advances in transplantation came out of World War II because the pilots, when they went down, were horrifically burned. And nobody could graft them. They died because their grafts were rejected. So he and Peter Medawar together studied the immune response. They did a classic experiment where they had this chicken membrane. They put in white blood cells from a different strain of chickens, and they could see how it forms this really thick little concentration. That's because these leukocytes proliferate. They recognize it's a different strain, self versus non-self recognition, and they expand in the immune response. And these guys realized that's probably exactly what was happening in transplants. When they looked in the transplant rejected region, there were lots of proliferating leukocytes. So later, people go on to show that that's mediated by T cells. So the T cells, in fact, Metchnikoff is right, cells are important, just not quite the way he envisioned it. But they're key for self versus non-self recognition. In this course, you won't get too much into the basics of that recognition, a little bit in the T-cell lecture, but major histocompatibility complexes are key for that. Okay, so here is McFarlane Burnett right here and his colleague Peter Medawar, very unassuming, very really kind people, getting their Nobel Prize in 1960. But this is what McFarlane Burnett was most proud of. He was proud of his getting a Nobel Prize, of course, but he's proud of this little paper. And this is all about the clonal selection theory. His hypothesis very much like Paul Ehrlich, of how antibodies are made. And again, he used drawings, and he didn't have a lot of data to support it, but he had this really amazing theory,
which mostly turns out to be right. And it's based on the idea if you have an antigen, it sterically will engage cell surface side chains on the surface of the antibody-producing cell, and that will trigger that particular cell to divide. You have clonal expansion, and meanwhile, that particular cell will make one type of antibody, and it'll shoot it out. So kind of amazing, really, you know, separated by 50, 60 years or more, that they're coming up with some of the same thinking.
All right, so the antibody response, of course, is key, and McFarland Burnett spends a lot of time on that.
But one of the things that is hard to figure out is who's making the antibody response. So this stain, and I remember this happening when I started graduate school, being shown a slide very similar to this with all the open questions. So this actual typical stain that they use is based on Paul Ehrlich. He created this whole hematology field as well. And so what you can see is different types of cell types. You can see the little donut-like red blood cells. They're easy to pick out. You can see neutrophils. They have multiple lobes of their nucleus. We all know that. Here's a lymphocyte. But back at the late 50s, the question was, is it the same lymphocyte that makes antibody that is also important for graft rejection? Or are they different cell types? You know, we know now, are they the same or are they different? Yeah, and what kinds of lymphocytes do we have? Yeah, everybody here knows about T cells because you guys grew up past the point of HIV, which is attacking T cells. So while the public didn't know about them before, everybody knows about T cells now. And they're also the same cells that fight cancer. So that was the question. And as you brought up, in fact, there are two cell types, but they look exactly the same under the microscope. So that was sort of the challenge of the whole thing. So a great serendipitous experiment happens in Glick's lab, 1956. He identifies B cells as the source of antibody. And what did they do? They were studying chickens. Chickens were the Nobel laureate, McFarland Burnett. He fed chickens up the wazoo. Everybody did. So that was sort of the tour de force of immunology until mice came into inbred mice. So surgically, they were studying in a medical school class the bursa fabricis in chickens. Wasn't really well known what it was doing, but they could take it out surgically and get really good practice on surgical techniques. Assistant mistakenly uses one of these bursa removed animals as a study, because they also studied ramping up the immune response. So it's something very easy to do in medical school as an experiment, and you could then study the antibodies in the serum. And when they did that, they couldn't get an antibody response, but they could still get a graft rejection response. So it was the first clue that, in fact, there might be different lymphocytes responsible for antibody production versus cell-mediated immunity and graft rejection. So they called these cells B cells, because they come out of the bursa. That's why we call them B cells. Luckily, in mammals, they come out of the bone marrow, so B actually holds up for us, because we don't have bursa. So, and then T cells, that experiment actually wasn't by mistake, but in Miller and Good, very, very famous immunologists, they identified the T cells as the mediators of self versus non-self recognition, cell-mediated immunity, and they come out of the thymus. So T thymus. So if they took out the thymus, thymectomized them, and challenged them with graft, they couldn't reject grafts. In some cases, they could make antibodies. It depended on the type of antibody, because, of course, T cells are important for a lot of antibody responses, too, indirectly. So that's how they figured out that there are two different arms of the adaptive immune response and why we call them B and T cells. So at least that's good for you. Next time you go to Ulrich's, you can sort of say why we know we have B and T cells. So you're going to learn all about this, the various immune cells of the body and the organs, but you'll have in your mind as you go into that, if you haven't had immunology, why we care. We've got the bone marrow, we've got the lymphatic tissues of the gut, including Peyer's patches, we have lymph nodes, we have the thymus, we have the spleen, and the cells come out and go in all the time. And in higher mammals, they can move. So if you infect your finger,
immune cells can actually be attracted right there. You don't depend like an insect, depend on it all coming to like a central splenic kind of organ.
So that's what makes mammals so sophisticated. Okay, so
this isn't so long ago. The understanding of the molecular analysis of B and T cells, the receptors, was analyzed and Nobel Prizes came out for that, for the T cell receptor back in the 80s. Identifying regulatory proteins, cytokines, that ramp up and bring back down the immune response and make a decision of the type of immune response you get, all came into play back in the 80s. My PhD thesis was on cytokines as well. Signal transduction, what happens downstream of the receptors? Oh, this is more recent. We now have a much better understanding, way too detailed for this course, of how the immune response is not just an on-off switch, but there are multiple signals. You have to pass each hurdle in order to get the immune response. If you have this one signal, but not the second or the third, you don't get it. In fact, you actually deplete the immune cells. We have a better idea of the types of cells. We're going to end on a Nobel laureate that identified one of the accessory cells that drive, they call it the master regulator of the immune response. So it's become much more complicated. And it's led to our understanding of host tumor cell immune responses to cancer, which you'll learn about next. Which is, you all came and heard Governor Kerry here. Cuomo. What am I talking? Kerry. Oh, my God. Cuomo, was everybody here in the audience for that? Was anybody here in the audience for it? Really? Okay. So if you don't learn anything more about immunology from me, when you have a really major groundbreaking thing and you're actually invited, you should go. Because you don't want to find out about what happened. And it was so groundbreaking in terms of immune response to cancer, Roswell Park being the first. You don't want to learn about it on the news that night when you could be here and get it. So, and as graduate students, that is what you're here for. You want to be a part of it. That's professionalism at the highest level. So you really, really, really don't lose those opportunities. So that might be more important than anything I teach you about history of immunology. Put yourself out there. Ask to go to things. Am I allowed to go to this? A lot of times, the other one, I know I've said this at the, what is that course? Ethics. So I have generated, I can't remember the name of it, but the Responsible Conduct of Research course, I know I said it there. Get out there. When we have speakers here that are picked to give these awards, and I look around, it was shocking how few students were at the last one when Joe Skitsky and I'm blanking on her name. I know her super well. So an epidemiologist gave really riveting talks. We pay for people to come for professional development. I looked around, a couple students, and all the senior vice presidents and the presidents of the institute were like, what the heck is going on with our student body? And I had to say in my own heart, I was like, whoa, because I even said it at every time I can. Get yourself out there. Don't you want to see what helped somebody develop their career decisions? Don't you want to see what works for you and maybe it's not what you want to do, maybe it is what you want to do? So get out there for it. And if there's a question whether you're invited, then you ask your mentors. You ask Norm Karen. You ask Hirschberger. So definitely do that, because it's kind of frightening to me when I see so few students coming to things, because it's the time when you learn about stuff. It's later you're going to be formed. Okay, so immune response, this is McFarland Burnett quote kind of thing in your book. He recognized early on, as did Paul Ehrlich. Paul Ehrlich felt the immune response could fight cancer. So, and that when we get cancer, just as Judah Folkman stood right here and said, we get cancer when there's an imbalance, because our immune response actually can take care of cancer pretty well. And for most of us, it does our entire life. So this is a famous study that was done in Gross's lab, 1943. You'll see it's very similar to the infectious responses. They took a cancer. They took it out. So this animal has been exposed to cancer, right? If they re-challenge that same animal with the exact same tumor type, it's protected. That's what we have to do, all of us in tumor immunology, every time we publish. We have to prove there's protection, and it's specific. If they challenge with a different tumor, they're not protected. So it's just like Thucydides. It's satisfying the rules of specificity. It has immunologic memory. There's also really important that tumors can almost function as rejection antigens, just like transplants. So pretty cool in terms of the field of tumor immunology. So this is what you're trying to achieve. You've got cancer cells being attacked by the immune cells. They're poking holes. Literally, they poke little holes, death holes, and the cells die. That's what we want to achieve. And yet the normal cell right next door is protected. And you'll get a little more of this when you hear Scott's lecture about the molecular interactions. Certainly a T-cell has a receptor that can recognize a foreign antigen, and that will lead to attack of that cell. So this is one of the very last slides. This is famous for the fact that Terry Boone started out this whole idea of trying to identify antigens that are recognized by T-cells. And so they would just do a simple thing. They'd take tumor cells. They'd break up the DNA because presumably the DNA is encoding for these variations of factors on the cell surface. So then they pump it into another cell type. So they put it in a plasmid, and so it's going to create that sort of same antigen. And then they screen it by looking for T cells responding. If the T cell doesn't respond to the normal cell, but it responds to this, that's going to be likely to be a tumor antigen. And so we have now, those of you that went to Olya Finn's lecture a couple days ago, we have hundreds of tumor antigens that could be targets. The trick is how to make a vaccine. One, you don't want to necessarily target something that your body needs all the time, unless you really, really have to, and you have, like, your cancer cells addicted to it. But two, the tumor cells are so clever that they, as soon as it's not a life and death for them, so they down-regulate that, whatever you're attacking, and now you have to have more and more antigens. So that it's a continuing fight to try to get this to work. So we're going to end on Nobel laureates. There are lots of Nobel laureates in immunology. These are just a few that I just put in. Here's a great example of transplant rejection. Here's another Nobel Prize that was given in 1996. We actually had Peter Doherty here at Roswell present right afterwards. But what he says is it's a wonderful example of how certain things cannot be planned. Keep your mind open to surprising results. A lot of times it's just mess, and something went wrong with our experiments that we can never explain. But sometimes, just like Louis Pasteur, their lab is exactly the same thing. It's a miracle of chance that they actually got their fundamental finding. But what gives them the Nobel Prize is they figured out what to go on to do with it. More Nobel Prizes that are foundation for the field. Again, transplant rejection, you'll see. Here's antibody diversity of the B-cell receptor was the Nobel Prize from Tanigawa, and so on. So I want to end with this. These are the recent Nobel laureates, too, got it in immunology in 2011. Butler and Hoffman, who also said that part of it was luck on their part, discovered what are called basic recognition that tickles and provokes the immune response really early on, within minutes of a pathogen coming in. And then Ralph Steinman, who looked in the microscope and saw this bizarre, hairy-looking cell, and in fact fought and fought and fought to get it published, because everybody said it's an artifact of your in vitro culture conditions, and these cells don't exist in real life. They turned out to be the linchpin between the basic innate immune response and the T and B cell response. And that is dendritic cells. So this is just from that, and this is going to be one of your assignments. So the innate immune response, very, very quick. Those are the natural killer cells and so on. The adaptive immune response, the B cell and T cell arm of the response. That's what that means, adaptive. That takes days to weeks. That's why we're super lucky that little boy, that 8-year-old boy, they waited 2 weeks because they needed that response for him to be protected against smallpox. It's slower, and they found out that these dendritic cells, these hairy-looking cells, in fact, are real, and they are the ones that are the bridge, so that you have sort of basic immune response involved these recognition receptors, but then these cells talk to the lymphocytes. They are what drive that clonal expansion, and you get a huge immune response. So the last piece is for the assignment. I want, for your assignment, I do want you to read that paper I sent out on Metchnikoff. Think about what we talked about. Think about the context of what he had to deal with. And even though he was so maligned, what impact he had on the field. When you read it, you'll be like amazed to see sort of how he really set the tone for what we think about in terms of cell-based immunity. But I'd also like you to research about Ralph Steinman. I don't care if you research it together and so on. Try to go beyond Wikipedia and get a good understanding of what I told you in 1977, JEM paper. He identify those cells. So get a sense of what he's done and what his key findings were, and then extend it, because he actually developed these same dendritic cells as a therapy for cancer. He treated himself for prostate cancer. He actually had pancreatic cancer. And while people should only live about 6 months when they're diagnosed with pancreatic, he lived for 4.5 years. Whether he's a one-off, though, you know, whether that is because of the vaccine or not is unclear. He's the only person that got the Nobel Prize, though, after they died. Because he died, so he never knew he got it. Within hours, they texted him that he got the Nobel Prize and he had just died. So they decided to go ahead and award it to him. So it's kind of a sad personal story. He's an amazing, really impressive man, if you got to meet him. But he used this as a therapy. So I'd like you to look into how these things that are underlined, because somehow that's going to come into your exam. Okay? And that's it. Any questions at all? This is an easy one. All right, so good luck, and hopefully this will set the stage for the next ones, which will be much more molecularly based.